Their organizational work done, the Klansmen raided a linen closet. They pulled white sheets over their heads, cutting two holes for eyes and another for their mouth. Then they raced outside and leaped astride their horses and swooped through the town streets, whooping and moaning and shrieking like ghosts. The Ku Klux Klan was born. Chapter 3. I was killed at Chickamauga. Not long after that first midnight gallop, the six men found a large abandoned house on a hill not far from the main road leading into Pulaski. The house had been wrecked several months earlier by a cyclone. High winds had left storm-torn trees where a magnificent grove once stood. A dreary, desolate, uncanny sight it was, wrote John Lester nearly 20 years later, but it was in every way most suitable for a den. Over the coming weeks, the Klan met at their secret den, where they dressed in robes and hoods and then saddled up. They tore through the countryside, crashing summer parties and barbecues, much to the delight of partygoers, who delighted in the silliness of grown men pretending to be ghosts. One night, the ghostly figures crashed a moonlight picnic in a beech grove outside Pulaski. One of the picnickers, a former Confederate captain, was amused at the long, flowing white gowns and tall, conical hats decorated with spangles and stars. The hats covered their faces, but from behind the white pasteboard, eyes peered out of punched-out holes.
"It was a pretty and showy costume," observed Daniel Coleman, who lived across the border in Athens, Alabama.
The shrouded men joined in the dancing, twirling their white robes about them as if at any moment they might fly. Some romped among the guests, teasing them in low voices that sounded as if they had risen from the grave. Others didn't speak at all, but moved about soundlessly, signaling one another with gestures. The biggest secret about the Klan was its secrecy.
"Its mysteriousness was the sensation of the hour," wrote John Lester at a later date. "Every issue of the local paper contained some notice of the strange order."
Notices such as this one appeared in the biweekly Pulaski Citizen.
"Take notice. The Ku Klux Klan will assemble at their usual place of rendezvous, the den, on Tuesday night next, exactly at the hour of midnight, in costume and bearing the arms of the Klan. By or of the Grand Cyclops, G.T.
The publisher, Luther McCord, claimed to be baffled by the notices he found slipped beneath his office door.
"Will anyone venture to tell me what it means, if anything at all?" he implored on the front page of the newspaper. "What is a Ku Klux Klan? And who is this Grand Cyclops that issues his mysterious and imperative orders? Can anyone give us a little light on this subject?"
Chances are Luther McCord already knew the answer, considering that his younger brother was the Klansman Frank McCord. The newspaper publicity and the antics of the group piqued the curiosity of readers. Soon other Pulaski townsmen asked to join. Some found their way to the den on their own. The disguised horsemen surprised others at night, blindfolding them and spiriting them away to the den, where the secret initiation took place. Most new members were former Confederate soldiers. At least three were local doctors. Like the six original Pulaski members, these men were active in their churches and shared a Scottish-Irish heritage, one long known for the belief in ghosts and spirits. The secret initiation consisted of pranks intended to embarrass the initiates. The Grand Cyclops asked the blindfolded initiate absurd questions. Once satisfied with the answers, the Grand Cyclops ordered,
"Place him before the royal altar and adorn his head with the regal crown."
A Klansman then led the man to a large mirror where he placed a huge hat with two enormous donkey ears on the initiate's head. The novice was then told to recite a couplet from the poem "To a Louse" by the Scottish poet Robert Burns.
"O wad some power the gifty gears, to see ourselves as ithers see us.
O would some power the gift to give us, to see ourselves as others see us." Once the novice repeated the words, the Klansman untied the blindfold.
As the newest member looked in the mirror, he saw himself looking ridiculous in a donkey hat.
"The den rang with shouts and peals of laughter," said Lester. "And worse than all, as he looked about him, he saw that he was surrounded by men dressed in hideous garb and masks, so that he could not recognize one of them."
That summer, as news of the popular club spread into the surrounding countryside and other parts of Tennessee, more dens quickly sprang up. According to John Lester, the Klansmen were at the time content to play practical jokes on themselves and others. That soon changed, however, when they realized that people who passed along the dark and lonely road near their den were frightened by the robed and hooded lictors, or sentinels, standing guard outside. When these passers-by asked who they were, the grim-looking lictors replied in eerie voices,
"A spirit from the other world. I was killed at Chickamauga."
The Klansmen were pleased to find that this answer especially terrified the freed people. One of the most vicious battles of the war had taken place at Chickamauga, Georgia, just a dozen miles below the southeastern Tennessee border. As the stories about the ghosts of the Confederate dead spread, many freed people avoided the places that the Klan dens frequented.
In this way, the Klan gradually realized the most powerful devices ever constructed for controlling the ignorant and superstitious were in their hands, said Lester.
It was this realization, said Lester, that transformed the social club into a group of boogeymen who controlled the behavior of the former slaves. Just as the slave patrollers had done before emancipation, the Klan patrolled the country roads, chasing and whipping black people who dared to leave their cabins at night. Some shot their guns at random. For some black families, it became too dangerous to sleep near windows and doors. One woman described how she and her husband and children slept on the cabin floor to shield themselves during the Klan's raid.
"Them Ku Klux just come all around our house at nighttime and shoot into doors and the windows," said Ann Ulrich Evans, who lived across the western Tennessee border in Missouri. "They never bothered anybody in the daytime. Then sometime they come on in the house, tear up everything on the place, claim they was looking for somebody, and tell us they hungry 'cause they ain't had nothing to eat since the Battle of Shiloh."
Speaking in eerie voices, the Klansmen claimed to be the ghosts of Confederate soldiers who had died in battle and needed water. They paraded about the cabin, showing off supernatural powers. They hid collapsible bags beneath their robes that collected the water they pretended to drink by the bucketful. They feigned an ability to dismember, taking off an arm or hand that was actually a skeleton bone hidden beneath their sleeves. They stood on stilts or wore tall hats to appear giant-like. Some pretended to be headless, carrying fake heads in their arms. It's possible that some black people believed in supernatural beings that they called haints or haunts. Many were the children and grandchildren of Africans, mostly from countries along the West African coast. Their parents and grandparents brought the cultural and religious belief called voodoo to America. Those who practiced voodoo honored the spirit of dead ancestors and believed that they could communicate with the dead through shouts, dance, and song. Some freed people who continued to practice voodoo may have feared that dead Confederate soldiers had returned from the grave to seek revenge. Slaveholders had long drawn on these African beliefs in order to cultivate a climate of fear among superstitious slaves. Some masters, overseers and patrollers had dressed up as ghosts to frighten slaves at night and to make them afraid of the dark. For some superstitious slaves, the tricks might have worked. Most freed people, however, weren't fooled. They knew that the disguised Ku Kluxes weren't dead masters or Confederate soldiers arisen from the grave. What frightened them were the well-armed, disguised white men who burst into their cabins, outnumbering their victims. As one freedman said,
"The reason I was scared was that they came in with their pistols and I was afraid they would shoot me.
Most freed people had learned that it was safer to go along with the white man and pretend to believe their tricks so that the Ku Kluxes would leave them alone and keep the violence from escalating into beatings, shootings, and lynchings. Some modern historians accept John Lester's account that the six friends formed the Ku Klux Klan purely as a social club, and that the club then broadened into a racist organization that regulated the lives of black people. The claim little evidence indicates that the original Pulaski Klan bullied or seriously terrified anyone during the first summer of its existence. Other modern historians disagree, saying that Ku Kluxing, as the attacks became called, was nothing new except in name. These historians call it inconceivable that the six men had no racist agenda from the Klan's inception. The six men had grown up at a time when the whipping and bullying of black people was culturally and socially acceptable and perfectly legal. It seems more probable that in starting their club, these men were finding a way to continue racist behavior widely accepted during the days of slavery.